It's a pleasure to be back. And Maxine suggested that you could watch the first session. It's online. It was already online the next day. That was very quick. I was very pleased. Or one could look at my book, which I'd be very happy to advertise once again. And what I talked about last week was basically chapters 1 to 5 in the book. And today I'll talk about chapters 6 and 7, which is the practice of the Karaites and their beliefs, mostly the practices. Now, it's interesting that...
I'm sorry, do you mind repeating just what you did last week, just like in 2 sentences for those of us who missed it?
I talked about the origins of Karaism and the history through the Golden Age in the land of Israel, through the center in Byzantium, to Eastern Europe, Crimea and Lithuania and a few other places, the fate of the Karaites in the Holocaust, and the modern Israeli community. Okay? What I didn't talk about was what actually the Karaites do. In other words, why are they different? Why is it the different Judaism? And so that's what I'll talk about today. And it's interesting that having different religious law is a boundary marker between the two groups. Now, when looks at the parts of identity, Jewish identity, one could look at theology, and one sees that theology really doesn't matter in terms of Jewish identity. In the same synagogue, you can have people who have many different varied views of what God is, what Israel is, about the revelation of the Torah, or the non-revelation of the Torah. It's harder to share a synagogue if you have a totally different liturgy and you have a totally different calendar, not a totally different calendar, but a different calendar. If you're celebrating holidays on a different day, if you're celebrating holidays in a different manner. So it's very difficult to have one synagogue. So that's why there are Karaite synagogues and Rabbinite synagogues, because they have different practices. What they do share, and why Karaism is a alternative Judaism, is their identification with the Jewish people. And it's that, it seems to me, that's the real boundary marker, whether someone is a Jew or a group is a Jewish group. When the Karaites in the Eastern Europe in the last 100 years denied their affinity, or they denied their Jewish identity, this made a real difference. They basically separated themselves out from the community. And trying not to be too sermonic, if you remember in the Passover Haggadah, where the wicked son, what is the wicked son's crime, as it were? He says, what's this work to you? And the Haggadah says, to you and not to him. In other words, he excludes himself from the community, Otzias Atzmo, the Hafar Be'ikar, and therefore he's a heretic. That's what stops a person from being Jewish, not the theology and not the practice, but the identification with the Jewish people. And Karaites, up to this day, those Karaites who do see themselves as Jewish, and the majority of Karaites today do, they're part of the Jewish people because of this identification with the people and the fate of the Jewish people. And of course, now with most of them being in Israel, they're certainly part of Israeli society. So that's one preliminary comment about the fact that religious observance is a boundary marker. The second one is that people tend to think...
I drink milk, but I forgot about the thing.
You didn't
take focal. No. Okay. I promise.
Thank you. People tend to say, well, why did the Karaites not do such and such? Why did the Karaites give up Shofar and Rosh Hashanah or Tefillin? And that sort of is the wrong question, because we don't, it implies, as I talked about last week, that there's one Judaism from which all non-rabbinic groups separated themselves, and the Karaites, being one of those groups, revolted, became a sect, and made up its own things and left what the rabbinic Judaism does. But no, there are parallel observances, it seems to me, and we don't always know why Karaites have the practices they have. But for instance, there are certain Karaite practices which are probably more ancient than the Rabbinite practices. For instance, I'll talk about the synagogue. In the synagogue, there's removal of the shoes, they're sitting on the floor, and there's prostration during prayer. So that looks very much like Islam, and people say, they got it from Islam and started in the Islamic period. But we know from the temple service that there weren't chairs. People bowed down completely. One of the miracles in the Pirkei Avot talks about the 10 miracles in Jerusalem. One is that even though people were crowded like crazy in the temple courtyard, when they had to bow down, when they prostrated themselves, there was plenty of room. Some of you might know that Mishnah and the Avot and the Ethics of the Fathers. One of the other miracles is no one ever said, I can't find a place to stay in Jerusalem. And there are those people who think that the explanation is not that there is no shortage of hotel rooms in Jerusalem, but nobody complained. That was the big miracle of that Mishnah Avot. But going back to the issue of Karaite practice, also the calendar, the Karaites insisted on calculating the calendar by observation, which is what we know from the Mishnah. And so some Karaite practices might be very old. Some of them might be new. Some of them might be a conscious attempt to separate themselves from the Rabbinites and the majority. And some of it might be things that someone made up. In any event, we have I didn't mention last week, but many people are familiar with what's called the Anan's Credo. Anan ben David, I mentioned, is the thought to be the founder of charism, but is not. But he is attributed with a statement, Chapisu Boraita Shafir, search scripture well, Ba'alti Shanu Al Dati, and don't rely on my opinion, which seems to be a ideal of each and every Karaite can make his or her decisions and his or her law. And there is, to a certain extent, there is pluralism in charism among themselves. But the idea is that one can use certain techniques to expand the law. For instance, there's a technique of using logic, or hekesh, it's called in Hebrew, qiyas in Arabic. A great example is the Bible, the Torah, prohibits aunts from marrying, from having relations with nephews. The Torah does not prohibit uncles from having relations with nieces. In fact, rabbinic Judaism, that's considered a very good thing, that an uncle should marry a niece. But Karaites, along with other groups, some of the Second Temple groups, said no. If an aunt can't marry a nephew, we can use logic to assume that that uncles can't marry nieces. So Karaite law developed in different ways, and we can't point out what part of Karaite law comes from where. Another issue in terms of the source of Karaite law is that theoretically they can use the whole Bible. In determining the law in rabbinic Judaism, at least according to Maimonides, one is not allowed to use the post-Mosaic parts of the Bible. In other words, the prophets and the writings, that all the halakha, all the Jewish law has to be based on the Torah itself. And the Karaites say, no, the whole Bible is revealed, and therefore we can use it for that purpose. And so this is a methodological difference between Karaites and Rabbinites. And a third point that I want to make before going to the description of the law is the idea of literalism. During the weeks, one of you, I don't know if you're here today, wrote me an email about how literalism is impossible. There is no such thing as doing anything literally. And to a certain extent, that's correct. If one looks at Karaite law, there are certain things that look like they're literal, such as the counting of the Omer between Passover and Shavuot. It says should be done from the morrow of the Sabbath, Mimocharat HaShabbat. Well, Karaites say that means the Sabbath. Rabbinites say that means the day after the holiday. And therefore, it would seem that the Karaites are more literal than the Rabbinites. When the Bible says one shouldn't see the kid in its mother's milk, the rabbis say that means that one can't eat any milk or meat together, including chicken with milk, despite the fact chickens don't have milk. Karaites say, generally, there have been different opinions among the Karaites, when it says don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, it means don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. Or the law, what's called the lex talionis, eye for an eye. Eye for an eye, ayin tachat ayin. The rabbis say that means only monetary compensation, but the Karaites say it's possible that it could also mean actual physical compensation. But like the rabbis, they understand that if a one-eyed person takes out one eye of someone who has two good eyes, now has one good eye, by removing the offender's eye, it makes him blind, which is not really an eye for an eye. And therefore, Karaites also understand it as sometimes as compensation. On the other hand, there are certain laws which the rabbis understand literally and the Karaites don't. So in Deuteronomy, when it says when two brothers live together and one dies without any children, the second brother has to marry the widow. But the Karaites say, but we know from Leviticus that a brother can't marry his brother's wife. And therefore, this means a far relative. It doesn't mean a brother actually, but some relative was far away. So the rabbis say, no, a brother means a brother and not a relative. Or mezuzah, when it says to write it upon the gates of your house, the Karaites say that means just to remember it, or it's tefillin, binding it on your arms and head. That's not really actually binding anything. So in certain cases, the rabbis are more literal than the Karaites. The Karaites are sometimes more literal than the Rabbinites. And there are lots of laws which aren't in the Torah at all, which have to be figured out what to do. For instance, the calendar. I'll talk about that in a minute. Slaughtering and food preparation. We have ritual slaughter, but the Bible doesn't say anything about how an animal should be slaughtered. How does one marry or divorce? The Bible mentions marriage, mentions divorce, but doesn't say how to do it. So both forms of Judaism were left with the question of how to determine what the law is. A major difference is that the rabbis claim that their interpretation of the Torah goes back to Sinai. That's an oral Torah, which goes back to Mount Sinai. And the Karaites say, no, their interpretations are human, but there are traditions that we respect, and that's, if not obligating every Karaite or every Jew, at least this is the way they do things. So we have two parallel legal systems. Sometimes they're exactly the same. Sometimes they're very different. So I want to start out with the calendar. This is the calendar, the Hebrew side, the English side, of Universal Karaite Judaism. If you open it up, you'll see that it looks very much like a pocket calendar that they used to make before people stopped using pocket calendars. The months are exactly the same months. The holidays are similar, but not exactly. The Torah readings are mostly the same. Very looks like a Jewish calendar. It's in Hebrew, it's published in Israel. But there are certain differences. There are differences in the days of the month. There are differences in when the holidays occur. They also, on each month, I don't know if you can see it, but shows how the moon would have looked or should look at the beginning of each month. One thing which is extremely interesting in this calendar is if you go to the back, it gives the dates of the holidays, and they have two different lists, one for the holidays in Israel and one for the holidays in San Francisco. And sometimes they're not the same time, because San Francisco is 10 hours later than Israel. So if sometimes when you couldn't see the new moon in Israel on a certain date, you could already see it in San Francisco. So some of the holidays in San Francisco are not the same days as the holidays in Israel for the Karaites, something which in the Rabbinite calendar is unheard of. All right, how does one determine the calendar? We really don't know what the biblical calendar was like. Calendar today, the rabbinic calendar today, is called lunisolar. It's based on the moon and the sun. Our months are lunar months. We have Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month, when the at the new moon, but the year is according to the sun, so Passover is always in the spring. As you know, the Christian calendar is only a solar calendar. The months have nothing to do with the movement of the moon. And the Muslim calendar is solely lunar, so that sometimes the month of Ramadan, when people are fasting, is in the winter and they have a short fast, and sometimes it's in the summer and it's a very long and hot fast. But the Hebrew calendar, both the Rabbinite and Karaite, is lunisolar. Interesting also on our calendar is the fact the names of the months, Nisan, Tishrei, Adar, those are not Hebrew names. Those are Babylonian names. And so there's a great influence from the Babylonian calendar to the Jewish calendar, both Rabbinite and Karaite. So how does one determine it? In the times of the Second Temple, they used to use witnesses. Witnesses would come and say that they had seen the new moon. If they satisfied the judges say, yes, indeed, this is a new moon, and declare it Rosh Chodesh. If the witnesses don't come, they say, okay, this day is Rosh Chodesh, but it's not the first day of the month. The next day is the day of the month. This system became very unwieldy, and we don't know exactly, there's a tradition, the 4th century, but that's very unlikely, when Rabbinic Judaism adopted a calculated calendar. A calculated calendar means that given the data that one knows from the movements of the moon and the sun, one could determine when Rosh Hashanah will be in another 30,000 years. It doesn't require seeing anything. Right? Karaite said, no, we're supposed to do it by observation. We have to see the new moon. Another aspect of the Jewish calendar is the leap year. In order to make the lunar calendar agree with the sun, one has to add months periodically. In the rabbinic calendar, it's 7 out of 19 years. In the Karaite calendar, it was in order to make Passover Chodesh Aviv, the month of the Aviv, which they interpret not as the spring, but as the barley plant. So they would go out and look for the ripening barley plant. If by the end of Adar, the 12th month before Passover, there is no ripening barley crop, they would add another month. But there, in addition to the issue of calculation, which eventually the Karaites accepted, and calculation and observation, excuse me, there's another issue, which is the rabbinic calendar has things which are called postponements, dechiyot. Many of you are familiar with the fact that Rosh Hashanah can never fall on a Sunday, a Wednesday, or a Friday. Now, why can't it fall on a Sunday, a Wednesday, or a Friday? If it falls on a Sunday, then Hoshana Rabbah, the holiday in which you have to beat willow branches, would fall on a Shabbat, and that's not good because that's forbidden. If it fell on a Wednesday, Yom Kippur would be on Friday, which means 2 days of Sabbath-like activity, Friday and then Saturday. So that's no good. And if Rosh Hashanah fell on a Friday, Yom Kippur would be on Sunday. Again, 2 days in a row of Shabbat and then Yom Kippur. And therefore, there are postponements. And the rabbis based themselves on the verse in Leviticus, which says these are the appointed seasons of law, which you should announce them in their seasons. And the word them, when the Hebrew is otam, is spelled as if it looks like atem. You should announce them. And therefore, the rabbis were entitled to make the calendar and put in these postponements. And the Karaites say, well, wait, it says these are the appointed seasons of the Lord, the holidays, which you should call in their seasons. And that doesn't say unless it's inconvenient. I mean, why not have Rosh Hashanah on a Wednesday and Yom Kippur on a Friday? So it's inconvenient. So it'll be difficult preparing for Shabbat. But who says religion is supposed to be convenient? So this was the one major issue, disagreement between the two groups. Another one was that because of the uncertainty as to when they did make the calendars by observation, the people who lived outside of Israel didn't know when the holidays would fall. And therefore, we have the second day of the holidays, Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyot. And the Karaites say, no, it says Sukkot is one day plus the intermediate days. Shavuot is one day. Rosh Hashanah is one day. Or Yom Teruah is one day. We don't need to add an extra day. So in Israel, also one day of the holidays, except Rosh Hashanah when it's 2 days, the Karaites have only one day for all of the holidays. Someone once asked me if the Karaites observe only one day of Rosh Hashanah, what do they do on the other day? So I said, well, they probably do what a lot of other Israelis do, which is go to the beach. But it's not a holiday for them. Eventually, the observation, the Karaites who try to do the calendar by observation realized that this was not a very efficient way of making a calendar. I mentioned last week that Muslims to this day still don't know a week before a holiday or day before a holiday, whether the holiday is going to be that day or the next day. So the Karaites eventually, especially when they were out of the land of Israel, also calculated the calendar, but calculated differently. So if we look at the Karaite calendar, I'd like to go through it a little bit and give an example of some of the differences. So start out with Rosh Hashanah. If you look in their calendar, even though they now call it Rosh Hashanah like most other Jews, they usually use the biblical name Yom Teruah. Now, I would translate Yom Teruah, but that's a little bit difficult because there's a disagreement about this as well. So that Teruah, taken by the rabbis to mean blowing the shofar, the Karaites understand it to mean a day of loud shouting out or loud praying. And therefore, the Karaites do not use the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. They call it Yom Teruah as the biblical term. It's one day. Often as this falls on the second day of the Rabbinite Rosh Hashanah, which means their Yom Kippur is usually a day later than the Rabbinite Yom Kippur. After that, the third day of Tishrei in the Rabbinite calendar is a minor fast day of Tzom Gedalia. They call it the fast day of the seventh month and celebrate it on the 24th of the month and not on the third of the month. You get to Yom Kippur, very similar to Rabbi Yom Kippur. One big difference is that children are expected to fast as well. There's no concept in charism of minority, majority, in other words, a bar mitzvah. One doesn't become obligated by the laws. As soon as one can observe the laws, one's expected to. Now, one would think that since there's no idea of this becoming old enough to observe the commandments, there should be no bar mitzvah and recently bat mitzvah in the Karaite community. But social pressures are much too great, and they also celebrate something called a bar bat mitzvah. But theoretically, as I said, fasting or other the commandments, is if the child can do it, they're expected to do it. The 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, between Yom Teruah and Yom Kippur, the 10 days of mercy, they're marked by saying penitential prayers. Again, much influence from Rabbinic Judaism, but also understanding that Yom Kippur is a day of atonement. Moving on to Sukkot, Karaites use a sukkah, much the same way as the Rabbinite sukkah. What they don't use is the four species, what we usually call lulav and etrog. Lulav and etrog, the pine, the citron, the willow, and the myrtle. What they say is, if you look in Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah chapter 8, it talks about their discovering, reading from the Torah and discovering the Feast of the Tabernacles. And Nehemiah and Ezra send the people up into the forest to bring back wood to build the Sukkot. And many of the same items that they mentioned there are the same items which are in Leviticus chapter 23 with the holiday when it describes Sukkot. So they say there's nothing, no indication in the Torah that one should take a citron and a palm branch and wave them. No, those are for making a sukkah. Going around the calendar, you get to Hanukkah. There is no Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a post-biblical holiday. We get to Tu B'Shvat. There's no Tu B'Shvat. That's a rabbinic holiday. We get to Purim. That is a holiday because it's in the Bible. Purim is in the Bible. But they observe it if in a leap year like we have this year. They observe it in the first Adar and not the second Adar. Partially because since they don't know if there will be a second Adar, they have to celebrate it in the first one. Passover, prohibition of leaven. Unlike rabbinic Jews who eagerly sell all their leftover leaven chametz products before Passover just to buy it back afterwards, they don't believe in such a legal fiction. They say you have to actually get rid of all the leaven products. And they say that leavening refers not only to bread or wheat or the five grains, but any product that has a leavening process can't be eaten or drunk. And therefore, they don't use wine on Passover because wine has a leavening process. So instead of wine, they make a grape juice out of raisins. So that's what they used for the wine for the Seder, the night of the Seder. They also they reject most things, and it was most foods they don't eat. Some of you may be familiar with Ethiopian Jewry and their laws. Also, very little is able to be eaten if you say any product or any thing that one eats, it can't rise at any extent, not just the grains. It really cuts down the possibilities of what one can eat. The Seder, the Haggadah for the Seder night, is much, much different from the Rabbinite Haggadah. It's biblical verses similar to their prayer book. It's much shorter. I don't know if Karaite children ask, when do we eat? In the Haggadah, they don't ask four questions. But again, I would assume there are a lot of, in a typical Israeli Karaite Passover Seder, there are elements which are taken over from general culture, let's say Afikoman. Certainly not in the traditional Karaite Haggadah, but I wouldn't be surprised if Karaites did also have some sort of ceremony like that. Counting the Omer is always from a Saturday night. For this year, this past year, Passover Seder was Saturday night. For the rest of the Rabbinic Judaism, it started Friday night. Of course, there's second Seder in the diaspora. And even though it was the first night of the Saturday night was the Seder night for them, they also began counting the Omer. So they and Rabbinic Jews observed Shavuot on the same day, on a Sunday, 7 weeks later. Every year, though, their Shavuot is on a Sunday, different dates of the month, but the same day of the year, same day of the week, I'm sorry. Whereas in Rabbinic Judaism, it's the same date, the 6th of Sivan, but on different days of the week. The fast days in the summer, instead of the 17th of Tammuz, it's the 9th of Tammuz instead of the 9th of Av. It's two fast days, the 7th of Av and the 10th of Av. And basically what they do is that they're observing the morning days from the first temple according to dates as they appear in the Bible, and not the morning dates for the first and the second temple as understood by the rabbis. Israeli national holidays, they observe with everybody else. They don't observe on a different day. All right, let's go talk about Shabbat a little bit. One of the famous things about Anan was the fact that he forbid the use of fire on the Shabbat. And not only could one not kindle fire, as says in the book of Exodus, but if one were to find fire burning in one's house on the Shabbat, one would be obligated to put it out. Which meant is that Shabbat candles were not allowed. Not only were they not a commandment, but they were forbidden. For a few hundred years, the Karaites adopted this view until the 11th century or so, when they said, well, we can't light candles, but if there's a candle burning, we could leave it burning. And then the 15th century, they said, you know what? We could also light candles in advance and not put it out, let it continue burning. In fact, one of their the last real legal authority, Elijah Bashashi, at the end of the 15th century, said, how could even one think that Moses and all the prophets would spend the whole Shabbat in the dark? He thought it was unreasonable. And so the Karaites adopted the use of Shabbat candles lit in advance, but without a blessing, and for use only for illumination, not for heating and not for food. So there's no cholent, there's no Shabbat hot dish in the middle of the day. And I think I mentioned last week about the poor Karaite Jews in Lithuania who wanted to find a way of keeping their houses heated in the winter on the Shabbat, and the unsympathetic authorities in Istanbul. It's interesting, though, when you ask, so what about electricity? So like rabbinic Jews, they more or less see electricity as a type of fire and to be forbidden on the Shabbat. A number of years ago in one of the Karaite synagogues, I saw a letter that was written by the National Karaite Council to all the synagogues reminding them that the prohibition of fire on the Shabbat includes air conditioners. So I understood from that A, some of the synagogues were using air conditioners, despite the fact that it might not be allowed, and B, the religious council was trying to get them to behave themselves, but probably not very successfully. The description I'm giving of Karaite practices of traditional observant Karaites, of which there aren't that many still today. There's some who people have different levels of observance, just like in rabbinic Judaism. Karaites on the Shabbat don't use an Eruv. Prohibition of the lets one a carry on the Shabbat. I won't go into the details. Those who know. There also a prohibition of sexual relations on the Shabbat. And what's very interesting is the fact that at least the earlier Karaites were somewhat leery or somewhat suspicious of the idea of violating the Shabbat for saving lives, what we call in Hebrew pikuach nefesh. Eventually, they certainly agreed that if it's if the danger to life is certain, then one should violate the Sabbath to save it. They're a little bit more questioning about a doubtful threat to life, but I think today more or less we'll agree that it's saving life takes precedence over the Sabbath. In terms of dietary laws, I mentioned the question of slaughtering. They slaughter the animals similarly, but they check for different signs to make sure that it's a healthy animal, and they also use a different blessing. That rabbinic Judaism has a blessing of thanking God for commanding us to slaughter animals. Karaites thank God for allowing us to slaughter animals. The same species are forbidden, in other words, pig and camel and rabbit. The same signs for sea creatures, scales and fins. But the big, big difference is milk and meat. And I mentioned before that most Karaites say that if there's a prohibition of seething a kid in its mother's milk, that's a prohibition of seething a kid in its mother's milk. Certainly this would not include chicken that don't have milk. And the way it's developed now is they say, okay, since we don't know what cow the milk comes from, we're not going to have cow meat and cow milk at the same meal, but we could have goat milk and cow meat at the same meal, beef and goat meal. So they can have cheeseburgers made out of different species. There are no separate dishes. There are no this whole difference between milk and meat, a whole system built up in rabbinic Judaism. And one of the things they say is that the dietary laws, the kashrut, the rabbinic Judaism, has taken over the place of the laws of purity and impurity. Karaites take seriously all the different types of impurities mentioned in the Bible, probably not the leprosy that can't be diagnosed today. But according to the Bible, one becomes impure, which means one can't go to the temple and partake of certain foods. One becomes impure as a result of certain bodily emissions, contacts with dead bodies, contacts with not kosher or impure animals. When the temple was destroyed and it was no longer possible to have the red heifer, which brings purity from contact with the dead, and no one was diagnosing leprosy, the rabbis basically said the only impurity that we'll worry about is menstrual and postpartum, that those still apply, those laws still apply, but all the other ones are in the diaspora when there's no temple or irrelevant. And for Maimonides, for instance, those laws are mostly irrelevant anyway, unless one wants to go to the temple. So certainly without a temple, they would be irrelevant. And the Karaites say no. They say the Torah says if you come in contact with a dead body, you are impure for 7 days. If you come in contact with certain animals, corpses of impure animals, you're impure. So impurity for them means, among other things, that one can't go to the synagogue. Women during menstrual cycle and postpartum don't come to the synagogue. And even men who have emissions and come in contact with the dead also do not go to the synagogue. When it comes to purification, the rabbis understood that when the Torah says that one should wash, it means immersing in a mikveh of running water, natural water. The Karaites say no, that if you have everybody immerse in a body of water, to a mikveh, a swimming pool, the water will just accumulate, will take on the impurity of the individuals. And therefore, what needs to do is to pour water over the impure person, and that will make the person pure. Today's life, that means taking a shower. So a Karaite who becomes impure, both from contact with, let's say, with the dead after 7 days or other ways of becoming impure, menstrual impurity, this is become purification by showering and not by immersion in mikveh. In addition, the Karaites make a distinction between regular menstrual cycle and irregular ones, as described in the book of the Leviticus. And unlike in Rabbinic Judaism, where the marital separation usually is at least 12 days, 11, 12 days during the month, for the Karaites, for a regular cycle, it would be just 7 days. So the waiting period for menstrual impurity is shorter. And then, as I said, it's becomes pure by taking a shower. The synagogue. If you look at the advertisement for this lecture series, you'll see the picture of the inside of the synagogue in Jerusalem. And there are men sitting on the floor wearing a tallit. If you could look closely, it's tied. The fringes of the tallit are tied differently than in the rabbinic tallit, the prayer shawl. They have a blue thread, but it's not from the special sea animal that the tichelet, the blue rabbinic thread is color is made from. And if you look at the prayer book, it's much, much different. It's not a takeoff on the rabbinic prayer book. If for instance, if you take the traditional rabbinic prayer book and compare it to, let's say, the conservative prayer book or the reform prayer book, you see it's the same structure, but it's certain things have been added, certain things have been taken away, certain words have been changed. The Karaite prayer book is totally different. The Karaite prayer book is traditionally was only biblical passages, mostly Psalms. Over the years, they've added other things to it. Most things are said like Sfaradim out loud, responsibly. And interesting enough, women now lead some of the saying of the prayers. Women do have a separate section. Men and women are separated. They think that's, among other reasons, is that since there's full prostration, it wouldn't be modest for men and women to prostrate together on the floor, which is the reason why women don't have an aliyah called up to the Torah, because again, they would have to prostrate themselves before having the aliyah. Traditional the Karaite synagogues have no seats. People sit on the floor, stand, or bow down fully. They do have a concession to old age. In the back of the synagogue, there's usually a row of chairs. It's called the Moshav Zakenim, which in Hebrew is the old age home. So if people can't physically get on the floor, there is a place, there's an option for them as well. The one part of the liturgy, which the Karaites are very proud is not part of their liturgy, is the daily blessing that thanking God, that men thank God for not making them women. And Karaites stress the fact that women are much more equal in the Karaite system than are men. And in certain respects, they are. In certain respects, they're not. But they like using that as part of their outreach program, let's say, quote that. All right, I see there have a lot more to talk about, and we're getting toward the end. But let me get to the part which I'm sure you're all waiting for, but don't even know you're waiting for it. And that's the issue of personal status. In other words, marriage, divorce, how do they relate to other Jews, intermarriage with rabbinite Jews, and questions like this. And this makes a great difference for the status of Karaites in Israeli law today and the ability for marriage. So there are some differences which are, I'd say, somewhat minor in the bigger picture. The expansion of the incest laws. I mentioned the Karaites don't allow uncles to marry nieces. It's not that often in Rabbinic Judaism that uncles marry nieces, but you can't have two brothers marrying two sisters, and they're much more strict in the incest laws. They aren't as strict as they used to be when Karaism began, because they found out that if you expand the incest laws too greatly, you can't find partners, and therefore they had to reform it to make it more possible. They also have patrilinear identity. In other words, a Jew is someone whose father's Jewish, not whose mother. I mentioned levirate marriage, yibum. They don't do it from the brother or the release from the brother, but from another relative. But the big problem is what in Hebrew is called mamzerut, which has no real equivalent in English. Mamzerut is a status of being born for an incestuous or adulterous relationship. In other words, a woman is married to a man. She has an affair with another man. A child born of that relationship is a mamzer and cannot marry other Jews. Now, in Rabbinic Judaism, it's very easy to get married. In fact, sometimes it's too easy to get married. You can just exchange. A man can give a woman a ring and say, you're married to me. And if she accepts it, it's basically marriage. You might need a divorce to be separated. But divorce is very, very difficult. It has to be done exactly right according to all the minutiae of the laws. So what happens is, if two Karaites get married and it doesn't work out and they want a divorce, if they go to the Karaite court to get a divorce, it's not a kosher divorce as far as the rabbis are concerned. And then the woman remarries to some other Karaite. She has children. As far as the rabbis are concerned, those children are mamzerim. They are the status of not being able to be married. So there's another issue in terms of the divorce, which is the Karaite courts can issue a divorce in the name of the woman. There's no such thing as a chained woman, aguna. There's no problem of having to run down a recalcitrant husband and force the husband to give a divorce to the wife. The court can issue the divorce. So if you have the possibility that there are people who are mamzerim because their marriages were legal, but their divorces were not legitimate, it means that you can't marry. And indeed, this has been a problem historically for rabbinite Jews to marry Karaite Jews. the rabbinites consider the Karaites to be mamzerim, to have the status of non-marriageability. And Karaites, to a certain extent, also consider the rabbis because they're different incest laws and their marriages and divorce. Historically, this has been overcome in, we know from the Geniza, the repository in Cairo of all kinds of documents, that there were ketubot, there were marriage contracts, which were between a rabbinite and a Karaite. There are basically prenuptial agreements in which the each side just agrees to whose practices they would follow, whether it was the menstrual purity laws, the dietary laws, the calendar, the Sabbath. And they would decide about this in advance. In the 16th century, there's a question in Egypt. The question arose, is they really allowed to marry? And Rabbi the Radbaz, David ibn Abi Zimra, declared that since the Karaites and the Rabbinites are so far away from each other, at a Karaite marriage, it's not possible that there were kosher edim, kosher witnesses, namely Rabbinite, observant Rabbinite Jews, and therefore the marriages weren't marriages, therefore the divorce, they don't need a divorce, therefore there's no problem of remarriage. And this view was adopted by most Egyptian rabbis, and Rav Avadja Yosef, the great head of Sephardi Jewry in Israel, who was rabbi in Cairo from 1945 to 1947, adopted this view as well. And therefore, most Karaite rabbis, most Sephardi rabbinic rabbinite rabbis will perform an intermarriage. They check to make sure there's no divorce. They ask the Karaite member of the couple to agree to become rabbinite Judaism. And I'm sure most of you know the system in Israel that the rabbinate has control over questions of personal status, marriage and divorce. And even though many, many Israeli Jews are secular, the way the system works, if you believed in two Torahs, you're a rabbinite Jew. If you believe in one Torah, you're a Karaite Jew. If you don't believe in any Torahs, you're a rabbinite Jew again, and you're subjected to the Israeli rabbinate. So there have been intermarriages, even though it's not officially the Karaite court is not officially recognized. They don't have de jure recognition. They have de facto. Recent years, Karaites have been willing to perform marriage. The Karaite courts have been willing to perform marriages of a Karaite and a rabbinite, asking the rabbinite to adopt Karaism. So this is very, I'm doing it very quickly and without the details, but basically there is intermarriage between Karaites and rabbinites in Israel, probably a lot more than the Karaites would like, because they'd like to preserve their identity, more than some of the rabbis would like, because the Ashkenazim don't accept such intermarriages. But the fact that this issue arises as to whether or not there's marriageability because of the problem of mamzerut, of this status, just shows the Karaites are accepted as being Jewish. Because if they were not Jewish, they could convert to being Jewish and there would be no problem. It's only when you're Jewish, but you have questionable marriageable status, that there is an issue. And therefore, the Karaites are recognized as Jews. The Israeli legal system does not formally recognize the Karaites even to do their own internal marriages and divorces, but de facto, they do accept it. I didn't talk at all about civil law. I mentioned the eye for an eye, that there is at least the recognition of the ability to, that it could be actual physically. It was Karaites, just like the rabbis, had very little use for civil law in the diaspora. And we don't have what their older civil law. So they did not develop it to the same extent as the rabbis did, or as the Talmud did. I was going to talk about practices and beliefs. I'm almost out of time. Let me just mention beliefs. The idea of what are the principles of Karaite Judaism? And the first Karaite, Judah Hadassi, who developed a list, Judah Hadassi in the 12th century, actually did it 30 years before Maimonides' list. And rather than going through the various Karaite lists, let me just go through Maimonides' list. and of 13 principles, many of you know them. First is the existence of God. The second is the unity of God. The third is the incorporeality. God does not have a body. Fourth, God is preexistent, eternal. Fifth, God is the only object of worship. Sixth, there's prophecy. Seventh, Moses' prophecy is the greatest. Eighth, the Torah is from Sinai, both the oral and the written Torah. The ninth, the Torah will not be abrogated. 10th, providence. 11th, reward and punishment. 12th, Messiah. And 13th, resurrection. When we look at this list of the 13 principles, Karaites can sign on to 12 and a half without any problem. They only have a problem with a half of the eighth principle, which is the oral Torah. If you look at Karaites' list of principles, which you can do in my book, chapter 7, whatever it is, okay, you'll see that there's really nothing objectionable from the rabbinic point of view as well. Many of the same ideas, existence, unity, incorporeality of God, prophecy, Moses. One thing that's interesting is that Karaites generally make knowledge of Hebrew a principal religion. Because if you have to read the Torah in order to understand what the law is, or even the whole Bible, and that's written in Hebrew, one is obligated to know it in Hebrew. Anyway, that is a very, very quick review of the difference between the Rabbinites and Karaites. Let me see if I can open up the questions and see what people are asking. Someone said Karaites in Israel insist on carrying themselves Yudim Karaim. Exactly. Someone asked about the Samaritans use only the five books of Moses. Did Moses marry an aunt? Well, it's the someone mentions Moses' mother. Yocheved supposedly is the aunt of Amram, the father of Moses. The question of Rosh Chodesh and David and Jonathan and planning the strategy in Saul. There's also another problem there, which talks about the second day of Rosh Chodesh, which the Karaites don't have a second day of Rosh Chodesh. Do they have Kohen and Levi for the first two Aliyot? Yes. Where is Purim mentioned in the Torah? The Purim is not mentioned in the Torah, but is mentioned in the Tanakh, and it's in the Bible. And Karaites use the whole Bible and the Book of Esther, someone wrote. Someone disagree with my interpretation of why you have the dechiyot, the postponements in the rabbinic calendar, quoting the Rambam. I don't think it's worthwhile getting into a discussion of that and whether the Rambam's interpretation is correct. So basically, Karaites don't have any fun. I'm not sure that's correct. And someone else says they do. They can always have ice cream for breakfast, for dessert. Okay. Why is sex prohibited on the Sabbath? Well, for Anan, it was there is a verse in Exodus that one should rest on the Sabbath. In sowing and harvesting, one should rest. And he understands that to mean that this is part of sexual relations, it's sort of like sowing, that would be forbidden. But later Karaites mentioned the fact that the Sabbath is supposed to be a holy day, and there is a relationship between holiness and not having sexual relations. So that before the giving of the Torah, it says that in the book of Exodus, that God tells Moses to inform the people that they should prepare themselves, they should wash their clothes. So Al Tikshu Al Yishah, that men should not approach women. And therefore, the Karaites say that the importance is the holiness of the Sabbath, and sexual relations would get in the way of the holiness. Whereas the Rabbinites say, the verse in Isaiah, that you should call Sabbath enjoyment, and therefore this is the enjoyment of the Sabbath. But apparently in the Dead Sea Scrolls also, they did not allow sexual relations of the Shabbos. About the Karaites, the laws against the Russian laws against the Jews, and the Karaites were exempted. I talked about the last time. Someone asked about whether they're on the triennial cycle of the Torah reading. Interestingly enough, until the 15th century, they weren't on a triennial cycle, but they were in a cycle from spring to spring, to Passover to Passover. In the 15th century, they adopted the Torah reading of the rest of the Jewish people, and the adopted also now Simchat Torah. I didn't mention that in the calendar, but even though Simchat Torah is not a biblical holiday, and in the rabbinic Jewish world, it's celebrated on the second day of Shemini Atzeret in Israel, on the only one day of Shemini Atzeret, Karaites have adopted that as well. I'm finding it a little bit difficult to follow all the chat, the questions. Okay, we're about at the end of the time anyway.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, fine. Go.
If Karaites follow patrilineal descent, then how can we intermarry with the Karaites? They might not be rabbinically Jewish.
Okay, so the assumption is, first of all, until the modern period, the amount of intermarriage altogether was not exactly great. When the Sephardi rabbis accept a Karaite partner to be married to a rabbinite partner, a man to a woman to man, they'll check to see family history, but they won't check too many generations back. And there's an assumption that the vast majority of people are at least Jewish from the point of view of rabbinic Judaism. But the issues of the problem of marriageability is really more of an Ashkenazi issue, because Rabbi Moses Isserles in the Shulchan Aruch and his comments on the Shulchan Aruch say specifically, quoting a 13th century French rabbi, that there's no possibility of intermarriage. And therefore, a mixed couple who wants to get married finds out which rabbis accept the halachic ruling that allows them to have those marriages. Someone I saw in the comment asked about Karaite conversions. There is provisions in Karaite law for conversion. They're in all the law codes. They mentioned about the method of circumcision and when to take the converts. For about 500 years, they did not take any conversion, any converts. They had internal rules against it, just as certain rabbinic communities have that prohibition. In the last 10, 15 years, they've started taking them in America. It's also an interesting thing. You can read about it in the last chapter of my book. Anyway, I see the time is up. Thank you for joining me. And one more week next time. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Looking forward.
You're going to speak about next week.
Next week is the intellectual achievements and the intellectual contributions to the Jewish people. Okay.
Thank you very much.